Hello and welcome to Blogosphere Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere, which hopefully you've heard of. But if not, Blogosphere is a media company rooted in the world of influencers. We run events, an influencer network, and publish a nationally distributed print magazine. And now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, be sure to tweet us your suggestions. Our Twitter handle is @BlogosphereM. And if you want to learn more about influencers and the influencer industry, be sure to visit blogosphere magazine.com and invest in a subscription to our essential magazine. We're excited to announce that Series 1 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the smart thinking money app, Yolt. Yolt is an app that I personally use, so I'm delighted to partner with them. You can sync your accounts, credit cards, and pensions in one view and track your spending habits, how much you're spending and what you're spending it on. I buy a lot of coffee. Yolt takes the stress out of budgeting and gives you the tools to achieve your financial life goals. For me, that's a trip to French Polynesia. Download Yolt for free from the App Store or Google Play Store today. Today on Blogosphere's Serious Influence, I'm joined by Anna Thorstetir, who is Head of Influencer Strategy at Mediacom. Anna has worked in the influencer industry since 2011, first in PR, then in marketing. She has worked with many brands and recently was a driving force in helping with Boots' Beauty Festival.
So my name is Anna Thorstetir, the name that I hate spelling out on the phone to people. But it does mean the daughter of Thor, which I suppose is interesting enough to explain when people say, what is that surname? I head up the influencer marketing team at Mediacom, but I actually come from a PR background of about 8 years. So that's kind of where I started. And obviously there was a lot of blogger work back then. You know, we didn't call it influencers or influencer marketing, but I think we've all definitely been doing a lot of it since a long time ago. And some people argue that, you know, it started in PR or in media or in advertising, but I think people just need to stop fighting over the turf and just kind of share it for each other's benefit, because it didn't really come from one place.
So what kind of years are we in when you start working in PR? What was your kind of education? Did you always know that you wanted to go into media?
No, I didn't actually. I mean, going way back, I'm from Bosnia, so I left when I was 10. I then lived in Tanzania and Iceland, and it was only in Iceland that I kind of thought about, you know, what do I want to study at uni? What do I want to do? That's when I moved to London, and that was 10 years ago in 2007. And then I did about 8 internships to try and figure out what it is that I wanted to do.
Well, you also came to London in quite a bad time, didn't you? 2007, so just before the crash.
Yeah, I mean, let's not talk about my student loan in Iceland and the Icelandic financial crash. But yeah, I mean, it was a great time, you know, getting to know the city and all these opportunities that you have here. And I took that upon myself to grab every opportunity I had. So I started my career actually at Mischief PR in 2011. And I was there for nearly 5 years. And then I went to a company called Citizen Relations, which is where really my influencer marketing adventures started, because it was non-existent for my clients at the time. And I was really the one pushing it forward through all the brief responses, trying to convince everyone to invest, you know, even if it was very small budget, just to give it a go.
So this is in 2011?
No, so this is between 2011 and 2015. I was at Mischief. So this is when we worked with a lot of bloggers. But back then it was all about gifting and, you know, just traditional PR, really. So there was no paid for content at the time.
And how had you stumbled into the world of bloggers back then? Were you following bloggers? Were you following YouTube? Were you at the business that it sounds like you were trying to push it forward? So what was the understanding of this world from your colleagues as well?
So I think a lot of people would obviously be reading blogs in their private time, and then that leads to finding other blogs. And, you know, I guess that's why I'm so passionate about the space, and that's why I love this job so much, because it was always very natural for me. And I loved following these people you know, whether I was at home or in the office, it was all very manual. We'd start gathering lists of people that we liked and that we thought fitted the brand well, and we would contact them and gift them and kind of collaborate with them. And as the years went by, we obviously quickly realized A, the value of that type of coverage, but B, also the fact that we're going to have to start paying them to actually get what we want out of it. And that was fair enough, because they're doing work and there are people who invest a lot of time in their content.
How did the gifting work at that time? Was it very much, here is a product, if you should wish to post about it, that would be nice? Or was it, here's a gift, you need to write about it? Because I think that the rules, there was sort of a lack of understanding there, because that actually is an exchange and therefore is sort of a promotion.
It was very loose. You know, we'd contact them and say, this is the brand, we thought you might like it, this is what we're launching or what we'd love for you to get involved with. And we'd approach it very much in a collaborative sense, that it was really up to them if they wanted to work with us. But it was very clear from the beginning that we didn't have budget to pay them. So it was just about how we approached them, whether they were up for it. And most of the bloggers were. And that was because we found the bloggers that fitted the brands well. For example, one of the brands I worked on was Ella's Kitchen. And they're a fantastic brand, fantastic client. So bloggers really loved working with the brand, even if they weren't getting paid.
How did that sit with you? And was that very much parenting bloggers with Ella's Kitchen? Was that the main group of people that you were interacting with? Who were your sort of other clients at that time?
I would say yes, mainly food and parenting bloggers were really up for gifting and that exchange of services, if you call it that. We didn't work with that many fashion brands. I believe a lot of fashion brands still do that. And again, if the brand is really well aligned with that influencer and they get a lot of gifts from the brand, I'm sure they'd be willing to do it with an exchange of services in that sense. But obviously the downside to that is that you would never quite get to achieving 100% of the objective you're trying to achieve. You might get some coverage out of it, but you might not have access to all the back-end data that you want. You might not be able to measure it the way you want it to. So this is kind of what led to me really moving to MediaCom, is because I felt there were too many gaps and I just thought there's this huge opportunity and, you know, like a floodgate of information and things that I could be doing that I'm restricted to not doing, either by not having access to certain databases or not having access to the levels of budget that I really needed to make really cool things happen for that brand and for the client and really see success for them.
Did you argue at that time, obviously you were working in PR, but more and more we're now seeing that PR companies do have budget to pay influencers.
Yes.
Did you find that you were in a battle to say, look, we do need to put some budget behind this because we'll get far better results?
Yes, 100%. I was still not too junior, but I wasn't even a manager at that point. And I was really trying to get the point across to, you know, internally and to the clients that we do need to start putting budget towards this and we need to start paying these people because they're putting in a lot of work and they're starting to expect it. And as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 bloggers start to ask for, you know, £100 per post, the entire industry is going to move that way. And that's exactly what happened. And yeah, I'm sure, you know, a lot of PR agencies will now have a lot more budget to put towards those kinds of activities.
Do you think that your clients, whilst you're at PR, respected bloggers and influencers on the whole? And do you still find today that there are lots of people that do just see the influencer industry as free press?
I think they did respect them. And that came from us who were very close to working with them, and we actually formed very close relationships with them. And that's actually a great value of PR even today, is that a lot of the PR agencies have very good relationships with these bloggers and influencers. I definitely think it's changed a lot, especially because of the time that's passed and the amount of statistics that we have to actually prove that it works. It's a bit silly. Sometimes you sit in a room and you think, I am literally proof that this works. Just look at my bank account and the correlation between the screenshots on my Instagram. But you do have to justify it, obviously, to the managers that we work with or the digital teams that we work with have to ultimately work with us to justify those spends to the people that are used to very traditional media. And now I'm speaking from a more media buying perspective. But I think it's a really exciting space to be working in. However, we still have a lot of education to give and there's still a lot of skeptics out there. I think the value of influencer marketing has definitely, in terms of people knowing about the value of it, has definitely improved.
Well, we're seeing statistics that saying, you know, by 2020, this industry is going to be worth 20 billion.
Exactly.
And it's one of the fastest growing forms of marketing.
It's not going anywhere.
In a whole global kind of advertising and marketing industry that's worth 600 billion. And it's one of the fastest growing components, which is obviously very exciting. But let's go back then to 2015. You leave Mischief PR and then you move to Mediacom. What is your role at Mediacom?
So after Mischief, I actually went to a company called Citizen Relations, where I set out to work on more global brands and campaigns. And I worked on P&G as well as Dr. Oetker.
Is this an agency?
Yes, an agency in London. And that's where I really started to shift more towards paid content for influencer marketing and really convincing my clients to invest in it. Like I said earlier, even if it was a couple of £1,000, which to them was quite a big deal to use for something new, it was all about testing and learning. And obviously everything we worked on was a success and they really loved it and they are still doing it today. So even when I left the company, I had secured a 1-year deal for 2 influencers. It was very hard to kind of leave that. It felt like leaving my babies, but I was very proud of kind of introducing those clients to the influencer world, I have to say.
When you were there and you kind of did facilitate that deal, what did that look like from start to finish? Was that like Dr. Oetker and then that was an annual campaign? How did it work back then when you were convincing?
We would approach it as looking at the general brief, which didn't have influencers in it. And we would recognize the opportunity and say, you should work with these people. And this is how. One of the things we did was a Facebook Live or like a cook along kind of thing around Bake Off with an influencer and a cake artist. The 1-year deals for the other 2 brands were predominantly food as well. So recipe development and promotion of their products, but across 12 months so that it is authentic and that influencer gets the opportunity to create the content that they want rather than being told, just post this one thing or post this month and nothing else. So we would negotiate and collaborate with the influencers, but we would give any kind of creative ideas to the client and justify why we should spend that money and what they will get out of it, really.
So with food influencers, was it across, obviously you've mentioned Facebook Live, in this period of time, so we're in 2015
to 2017.
So was it very much the clients, because that was sort of a boost of time when everyone wanted to be on YouTube. Is that what you found that the clients were asking for the most?
They didn't really know what to ask for, to be honest. It was, again, us explaining what the best channel to use is for their brand. And YouTube was great for food. But again, so was Instagram. People like Alpha Foodie, Samira, she creates incredible content, really visually appealing. But the stuff that she can do creatively with a food product is just kind of taking it to a whole other level that the client never would have imagined. So they really loved that, being kind of a part of a world that they didn't even think about before, and seeing what these people can do with their brand really authentically and really in a really engaging way.
Have you found, now that you've moved over to Mediacom, that clients are asking for specific platforms, or is it very much part of a multi-tiered social approach?
It's definitely multi-tiered. What we are trying to do is make sure that influencer marketing is part of that media plan from the beginning. Even if it comes off later, which happens often, we want it to be thought of from the very beginning and to be part of the media mix and the marketing mix rather than just a nice to have. Again, the clients will come to us asking for a response to brief. And because I'm the strategist in the team, that's what I focus on. And I will advise them on the best approach, whether that's one channel or multiple channels, it really just depends on the brief. So the great thing is that they do trust us and rely on us to give that recommendation. And that's why we love working on it day in, day out.
So your job title, is it influencer strategy, head of influencer strategy, or is it?
Yes.
Yeah. So was that the role that you came into Mediacom as?
No, I came in as associate director, and the role kind of evolved into that as I started doing more strategy and brief responses based on how the industry was growing and how Mediacom was evolving with the influencer marketing industry. So it used to be that kind of nice to have, and, you know, maybe we'd get lucky to get something signed off. But now it's definitely changed quite a lot since last year. And it's become, like I said, a part of that media plan from the very beginning, which is really exciting for me because it feels like it's just ramping up and next year is going to be much bigger.
So do you have a separate influencer team within Mediacom, and is that different to other agencies?
Yes, we do. So we are part of MediaCom Beyond Advertising, which is the content arm of MediaCom. We sit in the same building and work as an extension of the MediaCom planning teams. We have an influencer specialist team, so I head up that team as well as our head of production, Amy, and we only do influencer marketing. We don't do anything else, which is awesome because the production team is second to none. They're incredible at what they do. They find solutions to things within seconds, and I'm not sure about all the other media agencies, but I think that most of them don't have teams that solely focus on influencer marketing. They do other things like social channel strategy or some of the other channels that they work on. I know that Mindshare, also part of Group M, are growing their team. So I can definitely see that happening for all the agencies, though. And I'm seeing a lot of brands building out their own influencer teams or influencer managers in-house.
What sort of clients are you working across now? And could you give an example of one brief that's come in and a campaign that you have strategized from start to finish?
Yes, so all of them actually, we've strategized from start to finish, all the campaigns that have gone live this year. The most exciting ones we've worked on was Boots Beauty Festival. We worked together with Ogilvy on that. It was a great success, but the great thing about it was that it was a 360 campaign. It had PR, media, paid social, we had a Facebook Live, and we had a landing page, and we collaborated with the influencers to create content across all those different pages. So it was a really integrated approach, and that's kind of the dream of what we're trying to achieve industry-wide, I think. So that was really cool.
How long did that take to organize and pull off? You know, how many months is that in preparation?
I would say about 6 months, but it took a good 9 to 10 months to actually make it happen, to make it a reality, to get it signed off, to, you know, get everybody together to actually make it happen. Everybody's really proud of that.
What did Boots CMO want from the festival? You know, what were you pitching to them, and what deliverables did they want from it? Was it brand sentiment? Was it increased sales?
It would be what every brand wants, really. Ultimately, everybody's aiming for sales, but that is a very challenging topic, and the ROI topic of influencer marketing. But, you know, we have to think about why we started doing influencer marketing in the first place, which is brand awareness, you know, brand uplift, things like that, that we can actually measure now.
How do you measure that?
So you can measure brand uplift studies via Nielsen or companies that have done that in advertising. You would just shift that towards influencer marketing type of questions or based on the objectives of the client. Obviously, you would need a large enough number of, you know, your target audience or a large enough number of Instagrammers that you've worked with, or the influencer on YouTube would have to be quite large to be able to get that sample group. But it's doable. So in terms of measurement, things are really moving ahead, and Boots is definitely one of the clients that's ahead of the game in that. Obviously, I'm not going to reveal all the secrets of how we did that and how they measured that success, but it's very exciting that we're able to do that for our clients. And being at MediaCom really feels really empowering to be in a place where you can have access to those things.
In terms of, obviously, on the business side of this, the secrets of, is that just, you mean kind of the specifics on how you internally measure stuff, because MediaCom have their own technology, and is that,
yes,
you don't want to reveal because it's personal figures, or you don't want to reveal because competitors could find your secret approach and then replicate it?
I think, you know, ultimately it's not really a secret. MediaCom have an econometrics team, and it's essentially a bespoke measurement solution for clients that buy into it. Not all clients opt into it, but those that do have seen success with influencer marketing when it's measured in comparison to other channels. And when they see that, it's invaluable to us, because that's when we get bigger budgets, more opportunities, and everybody gets super excited about the space and about working with influencers long term. So I wish all clients could have that solution.
Why are some of them not opting in for that when, you know, everybody is after the data now and you have a solution? Why are some clients not doing that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure some of the reasons could be budget, probably, or maybe they have different measurement solutions, or maybe they are not quite ready to open up that kind of measurement.
What is the sort of types of budget that you're seeing flowing through into influencer marketing now from clients, and what sort of increases during your tenure at MediaCom have you seen?
Yeah, so the increase has definitely been significant. I would say more than 50% over the last 6 months.
Wow.
For a very small amount of our clients who have invested more in measurement and actually really dedicated themselves to seeing the opportunities within that space specifically, have seen huge success with it. And we're definitely getting regular budgets, even though we're not on a retainer. We do all the campaigns ad hoc as we're essentially like a production house.
Clients that are on retainer for the other part of Mediacom, yeah.
Yes, they're all Mediacom clients. Some of them are coming externally to us actually because they find out about our team and they're more interested in the identification process and the measurement and the way we do things. But most of our campaigns are within Mediacom from about 95 of our clients. Obviously, we don't work with all 95. Yeah. Maybe next year we will. That's the ambition. But the increase in spend and the increase in briefs from clients from the building in general has gone up massively since last year. So our team will definitely be growing.
I spoke to somebody at Ogilvy who was saying that they've spent anything up to sort of £500,000 on one influencer. Does that sit right with you?
I don't think we've ever spent that much. I've definitely spent that much on A-lister celebrity in PR. I would say
for social posts.
No, for a lengthy campaign, appearances, probably an advert, things like that would be in the hundreds of thousands. We have spent hundreds of thousands on a travel clients campaign, which is also a huge success. We've been working on that for 2 years, where we send influencers from other markets to that advertiser's country. And obviously, all the costs associated with that will be much higher than if you just paid someone to do a YouTube video locally. So
yeah,
obviously, the costs fluctuate when it comes to global campaigns.
So that's sort of a tourism board
Yes, and the global campaigns are actually the biggest budgets that we have seen. Obviously, the States are way ahead of us in terms of that. And sometimes it can be frustrating to get really tiny budgets and then, you know, even have that fall through. I feel like there's a huge difference between brands that are really, really understand it and are, I wouldn't say brave, but smart enough to invest in it and really kind of throw in a big chunk of budget towards influencer marketing. Even though there's still some education there, they're still willing to invest that. On the other side, you have brands that are still really, really nervous about it and don't feel like they can justify it to their bosses or don't want to be investing as much. There isn't really a middle ground. It's my job to essentially get the guys from the other side over to where everyone else is and kind of, you know, almost hold their hand and say, look, it's okay. Like, come with me. I will help you do this.
When the brands on the kind of flip side that you've just been describing, not the ones that get it, the ones that are quite nervous to explain it, what are their main hesitations? Is it brand safety? Is it the mainstream press talking about kind of fake followers and bots, you know?
I feel like it used to be brand safety, and then people realized, if you're paying for something, of course you have some form of control. It's collaboration, but the influencer won't work on something that doesn't sit right with them. So you're already, when selecting the right person, you're already setting yourself up for success because you're about to collaborate on a mutual interest. So I felt brand safety was in the past and now we've moved on from that. Obviously, bots and followers are a really hot topic right now, but I think...
Not just in mainstream press either. I realise I just said that, but all over. Bots and fake followers are.
Yeah, exactly. The funny thing is that we've all been aware of that before these articles came out. And there's an article on Mediacom's website at the moment where I talk about this. And I just want to nip it in the bud and move on from that because it's really not a big deal. Anyone who's an expert at this would not work with influencers with fake followers. Obviously, a certain percentage of fake followers is normal because there are bots out there. And we would say 5% is normal. It's not completely avoidable. But when you're selecting somebody, you know if they're authentic or not. And it's very easy to spot suspicious activity on someone's account because it's all public.
What is the due diligence that you go through when you select an influencer?
So we have a proprietary identification tool called Digital Influence Score. And we have essentially a list of things that we score the influencer by. It is a bespoke report for our clients. So it's also based on what they're looking for, but it's also based on the data that we have on that influencer. So very much an objective approach where we look at a very large pool of people and then narrow it down to a short list and then get costs and other things like that. Obviously, there's a subjective part to that analysis and a human analysis to it because you can't just treat it as a number.
What are the sorts of categories that you are looking at? So is that audience, demographic,
yes,
follow and unfollow?
all of those things. So basically anything we would have access to. Obviously it's becoming a bit of a challenge now after Cambridge Analytica and the Facebook API being shut and things like that. Recent news of Deep Social shutting down. But we do
that was overnight, wasn't it?
Exactly, yeah. So we would look at all the data we have access to, but then when we narrow down the shortlist, we will speak to the agents as well. So we would double check the data, do all the due diligence on things like all the audience data, demographics, engagement rates. We look at average organic as well as paid engagement rates so that we are benchmarking correctly and not kind of looking at a blue sky figure. And we would look at subjective things like how often do they post with hashtag ad? Are their posts with brands or collaborations authentic? And how their followers interact with them, if there's any suspicious activity, all those subjective things as well.
And with the how many times they post hashtag ad, is that something that would put you off if there are lots of hashtag ads? And what's
Definitely. I think influencers need to be really careful with that. They need to choose their deals carefully. Hopefully there will be more long-term partnerships, and I believe there will be. I think brands would like that too. Anyone who is posting a lot of product posts that looked quite random, and you know, every three or four posts is an ad, would look a bit oversaturated, and we wouldn't feel it is very authentic. So that person would probably not be considered in the shortlist, even if they were in the wider pool of people to be considered for the job.
And what is your policy with disclosing? What should it look like?
We always make sure that they post with hashtag ad. I believe that according to the ASA, hashtag spawn or sponsored means that you have only paid them or essentially donated to their business without having any form of control over their content. So the grey area here is that if someone is gifted and they are asked to post a hashtag for that brand or even asked to say what you think about the product, that is by the ASA considered as some form of control over the content, which then goes into that ad space. So I think there's a lot of content still in this country that is not being disclosed, but the followers are not stupid. You know, they can see that it's been gifted. I'm seeing a lot of influencers also start to talk openly about this and say, look, guys, I have an affiliate link here. You know, I would never recommend something to you that I don't really wear myself or believe in, but I'm just letting you know this is an affiliate link and I earn money from you purchasing things from me. And the more influencers are transparent about that, the less people will care, just like they did with hashtag ad.
When I interviewed Lydia Millen, saying, you know, affiliate links are brilliant because it means that that's just income that's continuing throughout the month, but it means that you can decide which brand deals to take and which not to take.
Yes, so I have thought about this recently because some of the influencers I follow will often post things just from one website. One of them is American-based, so she posts everything from Bloomingdale's. And it's a bit frustrating because we can't shop at Bloomingdale's, but I also noticed that she must have a deal with them or, you know, all her affiliate links are through there. And after a while, you know, I stopped paying attention because I just think she's extremely biased to one brand and she's not actually showing me an objective view on, you know, her shopping or her choices. Whereas influencers like Emma Hill do really cool hauls on YouTube and she'll say, you know, guys, don't buy as many things as I buy because I'm literally doing this just to show you in a video. Don't go out and spend thousands of pounds on this amount of clothes. Like, this is not normal. I'm just showing you stuff that I really love and that you can buy yourself. So I think influencers need to be careful with the brands they're associating themselves with and how many affiliate links they're using and whether it's just from one website, because people will see that.
I suppose it's a fine balance. You don't want to be having too many ads for multiple brands, but you don't want to just isolate yourself to one brand.
Exactly. It's a challenge for them. But again, it goes back to the basics of why are you doing this? You know, remaining authentic and just being yourself. And once it gets too much towards the goal of making money, it's going to become apparent to their followers that the reason why they're doing stuff is just to make money.
Which is why sort of earlier you were talking about how multiple hashtag ad displays sort of forms of advertising across social media doesn't sit right when there are too many, and that longer form campaigns and direct relationships with influencers seems to be increasing. And from my perspective, this is what I'm hearing too.
Yes.
So where does this leave influencer platforms who are very much in the media buy territory, and it is very much product, display, ad.
Yeah, I thought you might ask that, because we do work with some of those guys, and we have another proprietary buying model at Group M where we guarantee engagement, and it's through our vetted suppliers. I do think there's still a space for those guys. I just think, again, it all comes down to the objectives and what you want out of it as a brand or as a client. If you have an event or a product launch, or you just want to create loads of buzz at any one time, then it's perfect, because you want loads of people talking about your product, or you want loads of seats at an event, or you want loads of people kind of talking in a story to swipe up at something that's maybe only available for 24 hours. So I think it's fine when it comes to scaling it or content creation. So a lot of these platforms are offering services where they're just creating content for the brand's social pages. Some of them are not even setting that content live through the influencers. They're just using them for, you know, like a production house to create beautiful imagery of their products. If everybody just focuses on their specialism and what they do best, then every business will thrive. But I think what's happening in this industry is that everybody is trying to do everything, and everybody wants a piece of the pie. And we're getting a load of companies that are springing up and saying they can do everything, but actually they can't. And the danger of that is that the clients that may be fearful of using influencer marketing will go to someone who's maybe cheaper, and it will go wrong. And I guarantee you it will go wrong. And we often get people coming to us after it's gone wrong, because they think, oh, you know, I really screwed up. I should have used this team for this and not that team just because it was cheaper. So I sometimes get anxious about clients being put off completely from influencer marketing if they've worked with the wrong people or if they've worked with the wrong team.
Because it's surely in the platform's interest to say that macro influencer and mid-tier influencer is dead, because it's in their interest to just have micro influencers, to tell brands that all they need is micro influencers to push the product and get that scale. But you're saying it's more part of a pie. But if the platforms were right, then would that jeopardize your position at the agency? You know, what is their agency's role?
No, I mean, I definitely think these platforms are great for what they're capable of, but they still need management. And again, it's a very time-consuming task to work with influencers, and you need the right team to do that. You need all the legal documentation. Our team would not use a platform's or another agency's documentation without putting our own stamp to it. And that's what a lot of people do, and that's when it goes wrong. You have to protect your brand and your client's interest at the same time. You can't just hand it over to another platform or team to do all of that for you. So there's kind of a, like you said, there's a piece of the pie for everyone, but not everyone can have all of it. And then people are just trying to say that they can do everything when it's just not true. And a lot of brands that are maybe not as knowledgeable in the space because they're focusing on something else that they're an expert at will fall victim to someone saying, I'll do all of it for you. You know, just give me the money and put it into this kind of machine and it'll get done.
And lots of people, that's really sort of glorified lists of email addresses that they've scraped publicly. So would you ever consider then building a competitor to, say, Takumi, Bazool, and have in-house at Mediacom?
I personally don't think that's happening. I think we can all learn from each other. I can't speak for any of the other kind of groups. I don't know if that will happen. I think that at the moment we are all working together. And like I said, it's really about the strategy. Micro influencers are great in one scenario, but they're not in another. And the same goes for macro influencers. So it's really about the objectives, what the brand needs out of it, and whether long form content and short form content works better for their brief. Because I always say this, you know, there isn't a one fits all solution for influencer marketing. People are kind of saying, oh, it's easy, it's simple. It's not. We need to be honest. You know, we're working with creatives, with people. They're not a machine, they're not a number. So in order to make your campaign a success, you need the right strategy, you need the right specialist team, you need the right brand protection and documentation behind it. And then, you know, you can enjoy the process of collaboration and have fun with it, and you will see success. But if those things are not done up front correctly, then you're setting yourself up for failure.
I think that's a very interesting point, and that there are lots of people that are seeing influencers not as people and as machines, and that A equals B.
Yeah.
But it's not the case, and it is a collaborative effort, and they are, you know, creatives and people, and that actually when a bit of respect is shown, then the result is going to be a lot better.
Exactly. And I think that's why we need people like my industry colleagues and myself who are constantly educating on that and explaining to everyone that it's, you know, especially in the media agency world, it is not another media buy. Although you can buy certain content in that format, and that is how it's being sold, when you get into the production process, it's not just a media buy. You can't just, you know, book it and then see the result. There's an entire collaboration and content creation process. But if you don't have people like us educating on that, then it's going to get lost and things will go wrong. And like I said, people might be put off it completely when actually it's a very exciting type of marketing that they should be using and can see success from.
When you finished a campaign, do you give feedback to influencers on how the campaign has gone and how the client feels? Because a lot of influencers are complaining about the lack of feedback.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because most of our contact is with their agents and we always give honest feedback. We put learnings in our post-campaign analysis to clients and we take from them too. And like any production, there will always be hiccups and challenges and learnings. We pass that feedback on to their agents, so we would hope that they will tell them as well. Some of the influencers we have personal relationships with that we've worked with over a long period of time, so we will tell them. But yeah, I would say we would hope their agents will feed that back to them and that it can continue to be a constructive feedback process between the two. And we'd hope that they wouldn't get angry about it, because at the end of the day, it is still a job, it's a production, and you know, things happen. And if we can just talk about it and not maybe be childish about it, then we will work with them again next time.
What is your process like working with agents?
So we would approach them in the identification process, like I said, when we have a shortlist of people and we want to double check the data, maybe their availability and costs that we would put in that report for the client for DIS, Digital Influence Score. And then once the influencer is chosen by the client, we will negotiate all the deliverables with the agent. And then what I'm encouraging our team to do more is actually meet in person with both the agent and the influencer and then discuss the content in person rather than on email, because that is what still happens a lot.
Do you find that agents are happy to meet in person with the
client? Oh, yes, 100%. This is going to sound really cheesy, but we love the agents. I think they're really great, you know, because they're so close to it, they really get it. And I just love meeting people who really get it. You know, we're fully immersed in the space and we're all after the same result, really. So most of our relationships are with the agents more than the influencers. But I would really hope that we will get to meet the influencers in person more when it comes to that briefing process, because I just don't think that is done enough. And I think as agency people, we probably don't have enough insight into how it is for the influencer through this business process, because we take it very seriously. A lot of money is involved, the brand's reputations, all of that stuff. And sometimes we don't know if the influencer is taking it as seriously as we are, because it's a very transactional relationship over email with their agent. So that's why I'm encouraging the team to meet with them more when it comes to that briefing process, so that everybody feels a part of this collaboration and that it's a lot easier to communicate.
Is that more on a macro level when you're meeting people rather than micro level?
Yes, definitely. But it could be micro as well. You know, if we're working with very niche influencers that don't have a huge reach but have very good engagement on a certain topic, then it's to do with a very tight brief or a very niche brief where we need to discuss it with them on how it's going to be executed.
What do you think of the movement of some of the macro influencers who have left their agencies and then instead are hiring someone in-house personally to manage their campaigns? Have you moved with some of those macro influencers when they've moved away from their agencies?
I think we've worked with a few of them. I wasn't aware that they were hiring personal agents.
Someone on their personal payroll to manage.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very clever for them to be closer to that, and that's probably why they're doing it. Only time will tell whether that works for us as brands and agencies. I would just hope that those people have experience on the business side, because I think that's where the danger comes in, is, you know, if you've got a friend doing it for you. They may not have experience with contracts and things like that, that I said, you know, are very serious things that when it comes to brands and the budgets that we're spending. And, you know, some influencers are maybe not aware that there is a chain of as many as 30 to 50 people involved in the content that they're making and the approvals of that budget and that content.
Do you think there need to be that many people in the chain?
No, and I think it will definitely be less as time goes by. But I think as it's still considered quite a new space, and like I said, people are still skeptical, there's still too many cooks in the kitchen. But with the brands that have seen success, that will massively go down. Once that trust is established and the company has seen success, you won't need to go as high up the chain to get 10 more people to approve the budget or justify that activity.
And also in terms of new small specialist influence agencies that are popping up. I think the statistic was 230 new ones just this year alone.
Yeah.
Is their future precarious? Because it seems like lots of briefs are just, the same brief just gets passed around with people putting a 40% margin on top.
Yeah, so I think that seems to be happening a lot with maybe some teams that don't do influencers day in, day out. And this is especially in America, everything is done by a third party. So agencies will hire other companies to do the work for them. Like I said, our team try and stay away from that as much as possible. We would only use help when we are under-resourced. But we prefer to be much closer to all the work simply because, like I said, too many cooks is just too much. And the closer we are to the briefing process, the conversations with the influencer, the more successful that campaign. It's a little bit concerning, I guess, the amount of people sometimes that are in that chain. So sometimes if we do something through a media owner, some of them may have hired another influencer company, but they may say that it was in their network or that they are doing it themselves, which is simply not true. So we just don't know sometimes, but we try and avoid it where possible. And I think, like with everything in this industry, all these companies that have come up, whatever their cause or whatever their objective, you know, ultimately in the next 2 years or in the next year even, most of them, I think, will disappear. It's just not sustainable to have this many. Everybody's just using influencer marketing as a bit of a cash cow, but the ones that are doing it right and are kind of consistent in their production and in their education will be the ones that prevail and that grow as a team.
And we've seen some horror stories as well over the past few years. I mean, we had the collapse of Mode Media maybe 2.5 years ago, and recently, I think it's Brand New IO, which allegedly is part of Mediacom. Is that
it? It was, yes. We were using them as one of the sources to find.
That wasn't your company?
No.
Okay. What's the fallout been? Have you had any impact, apart from allegations that it's your business, which it's not, which is good to clarify,
yeah,
with influencers not being paid? Because I think the CEO released a statement on Twitter that said that no payments will be made to influencers from January the 1st to June the 1st. This is paraphrasing, but they're still taking on new campaigns now. But a lot of influencers have just been, you know, left out of pocket. And if it's a client that you were working with and then going through that third party, how does that affect you? You know, what would you respect the paying them for the work they've done through that campaign? Or does the liability sit with Brand New?
So I wouldn't be able to comment in detail on that because it is a legal matter. It is with our teams. And all I can say is that they have done everything they possibly can for those bloggers in terms of the legal part of that. And then ultimately what happens, I don't know what will happen. It's not actually sitting with me, it's with our legal department. But I believe that they're doing everything they can for the bloggers. It's actually got nothing to do with us, but we are doing what we can as a goodwill gesture and because we respect them and because we want to resolve it for them.
Yeah.
But a lot of companies would have walked away and said, not my problem. And we're not doing that. We're doing the opposite.
I suppose some of the other companies maybe don't have the resource behind them and they put the money in and the money's just been swallowed. So there actually isn't any more to give, even though it should be going to the influencers.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, legally, it will sit with whoever the influencers signed their T's and C's with.
Yeah.
But whether the companies associated with that are doing anything to help the situation, we definitely are, yeah.
Which leads back to your point, it's so important that people do have people around them that do understand the business side and the contracts and look at the small print.
Yeah, exactly, because it's important for the influencers to think about this as a business for themselves. And I'm sure they do, but maybe some of them are forgetting that they are dealing with huge corporations and that has repercussions, and they need to be careful what they say on social media because they will be involved in legal proceedings with those companies. And so I think, you know, over time, influencers will need to realize that ultimately they are a business and they are responsible when there is money involved and there's legal documents involved. So
I think that also comes down to affiliating with the right brands as well, because although you may not be brand safe for one brand, you may be brand safe for another.
But that goes down to that identification and how
exactly
crucial that is.
Which is your role,
yeah,
as well.
If you don't get that right, everything else will go wrong. You know, some people will just pick an influencer from nowhere and say they look nice, but they've never looked through their content. And there may be something that they said that is completely detrimental to their brand. And, you know, it's just, it's really, really important. And I think more agencies need to take more responsibility on that process of identification and not just putting people in decks that look nice.
And then finally, what are your predictions for the industry over the next year or two?
You know, the obvious things are budgets are definitely going to get bigger, but then so is the responsibility.
Is how many people it's going to be spread across. So budgets are going to be bigger, but actually your personal prices might not increase that much because there are so many people after the same jobs.
Yeah, so I think in terms of the influencers charging more money for the same type of content, they probably wouldn't get away with that unless they had a good justification as to why, you know, if their following had grown massively or something like that. But budgets will get bigger in terms of us being able to spend more on influencers. And, you know, ultimately that means their fees going up because we'll be asking for more deliverables. So they won't be charging, you know, 50% more for one post. We'll just be able to pay them for five.
Yeah.
I think another prediction probably is that we will move more forward with measurement. I think there's a huge pressure for that, especially with the budgets going up. And, you know, it's going to be maybe a bit of a competition as to who will do it best. And then that will kind of whittle down the agencies that are doing the best jobs in terms of identification, production, and ultimately measurement. So, you know, proving the success of influencer marketing and getting more brands on board, really.
A big thanks to Anna for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere Serious Influence with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.com for influencer industry updates. And why not treat yourself to a magazine subscription whilst you're there?